The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Ray Dittinger. Five-time Pennsylvania Sports Writer of the Year, Ray Dittinger covered the NFL for the Philadelphia Bulletin and the Philadelphia Daily News for over 25 years. He has authored or co-authored 11 books about sports and sports writing, including the Eagles Encyclopedia, which he wrote with the late Robert S. Lyons. Called the definitive book for any Eagles fan, Go Birds, by the Philadelphia Daily News. A revised and expanded edition was published in 2018 to reflect the 87-year-old team's victory in Super Bowl 52. I don't need to tell any of you this. You all know this stuff. Ray currently hosts a talk show on 94 WIP Sports Radio and serves as a football analyst for NBC Sports Philly. He joins us tonight with his new memoir, Finished Business, My 50 Years of Headlines, Heroes, and Heartaches. It explores his childhood in Southwest Philly, his five-decade career covering a wide variety of sports across multiple media platforms, and the art of balancing being a longtime Eagles fan with being an objective journalist. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Michael Smirkanish, the host of the Michael Smirkanish program on Sirius XM POTUS Channel 124, the host of CNN's Smirkanish on Saturday mornings, a Sunday Philadelphia Inquirer columnist, and a New York Times bestselling author. So, Ray, Michael, thank you so much for being here, and take it away.
Ray, I told you privately in an email, I read and loved the book.
Thanks.
And what I really appreciated about the book is that I think you had a difficult task in wanting to have enough inside information for the fanatic, you know, to salve all the desires that they have for the nitty-gritty. But it's also approachable for the casual fan, and the stories in it are just terrific. So congratulations. And I'll also give a shout out to Temple, because I think that the production values and the packaging are extraordinary and the photographs are well done. So it's something about which I think you should be really proud.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, and I'm glad you said that about the Temple Press people. They did a really wonderful job putting it together. It's a really handsome book. I love the way it looks, and I'm happy you like the way it read.
I have a habit of reading acknowledgments first. I go to the end of the book. In your case, that would be the epilogue, and I'm always rewarded with a nugget when I get there. In your case, it's 1995. You're recognized with the Dick McGann Award from the Professional Football Writers of America. You are fielding many congratulatory notes and messages, including receiving a communication from Ed Gephardt of the Delaware County Daily Times, where you had worked for a year in 1968.
Yeah.
What was his message, and why was that his message?
That was the first job I got out of college. I graduated from Temple June of 68, started to work at the Delaware County Daily Times. Graduated on a Friday, started at the Daily Times on Monday. They didn't have an opening in the sports department. The only opening they had was on news side. They had three sports writers. They didn't have enough budget to add a fourth. So the editor said, you know, we'll hire you, but it's not going to be for sports. You're going to be covering news. You're going to be covering media courthouse. You're going to be covering transit strikes, murder trials, bake sales, all that kind of stuff. I said, fine. I was just happy to have the job. But I knew that on a typical Saturday in the fall, they couldn't cover all the Delaware County high school football with just three guys. So there were going to be a couple games out there that they needed other guys to cover, to work. So I volunteered, and Ed Gephardt was the sports editor, longtime sports editor, had been there forever. He always gave the best games to his three sports writers, the three staff guys. And those of us that were either freelancers or news side guys picking up a little overtime, we kind of got the B-list games. And so 4 or 5 weeks into the season, you know, I kind of got tired of seeing Sharon Hill. You know, I kind of got tired of seeing Clifton Heights. Nothing personal. But I, you know, I'm starting to feel, you know, hey, come on, I want to go see a, I want to see a big game. And the big school out there, and it still kind of is, was Ridley. Ridley is a real power and has been a real power in high school football for a long time. And so I kind of wanted to go see Ridley. And so I sort of summoned up my courage one day, and I walked over to Ed Gebhard's desk. And I said, hey, Mr. Gebhard, just thinking, you know, this, how about letting me cover Ridley on Saturday? And Ed looked up at me, peered over his glasses at me, and he said, yeah, you're not ready for Ridley. So I went, you know, I went off to Sharon Hill again that weekend. But it was so, it always sort of stayed with me, this idea, you know, you're not ready for Ridley. But as you point out, 1995, after I get the Dick McCann Award at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, for years of covering pro football and stuff, I came home and there was a whole bunch of cards and letters and very nice wishes from people saying congratulations, nice career achievement. But I went to the telephone and there was a voicemail message. And as soon as I hit the button, I recognized Ed's voice, and Ed said, okay, Dinger, you're ready for Ridley.
Oh my God. I love that, because it suggested that as it had hung with you, he had also remembered when he had to give you that line those many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly right. Yeah. I laughed so hard. And, I've been at a couple dinners, like Ridley Township Old Timers, Delco Sports Hall of Fame, a couple of events over the years where Ed has been on the dais. And I've told that story and always gotten a big laugh. And the person who laughs the loudest is Ed.
Love it. Maybe it was all preordained. Our Lady of Peace, Sister Claire Ursula. Dinger, you should be a writer, she says.
Fifth grade. She was my fifth grade teacher. Very tough. Woo, very tough, as the Sisters of St. Joseph's tended to be, probably still are. And she gave us an assignment in class one day. She said, write an essay. Everybody in class, I want you to write an essay about the person you most admire. And so everybody just puts their heads down and they start writing, me along with everybody else. And I wrote an essay about my father. Because even at fifth grade, I just found him to be just an incredibly admirable person, World War II veteran, you know, guy that worked multiple jobs, went to night school. Even in fifth grade, I knew that he was made of pretty stern stuff. And so while all the other kids are writing essays about Davy Crockett and President Eisenhower and a couple girls writing about Elvis Presley, I wrote this essay about my father. Didn't think a whole lot of it. We all turned the stuff in. And the next day, Sister Claire came into class with all the papers marked. And she starts off by saying, I want to read you all an essay written by one of your classmates. And she starts reading it. And I immediately realized, I said, wow, that's mine. And she read through the whole thing. And when she got to the end, she said, exactly what you said, Mike. She said, Mr. Dittinger, you should be a writer. And you know, Mike, it was the first time in my life anybody ever told me I was good at something. And when that happens for you, whether it's the third grade, the fifth grade, the eighth grade, whenever, it's pretty profound, you know? And at that point, I can't tell you I knew at that moment that I was going to go and study journalism in college. But I started thinking about it. And that was really one of the first big moments in my life that I began to think that this writing thing might actually lead somewhere.
I loved that you gave shout outs to your St. James High School English teachers, Donald Bell and John Mooney. Ray, there are many moments in the book, and when people read it from our area in particular, they're going to similarly say, I remember exactly where I was.
Oh, sure.
When that happened. And there was one particular instance where our lives, the two of us, intersected in a way that you don't know. It's the summer of 1970, and at Albright College in Reading, you are now at your first Eagles training camp. Interesting, by the way, for among other reasons, John Carlos is two summers removed from raising a fist in Mexico City. Yeah. I love this story. He's a sprinter. He's a runner. He doesn't know how to put on his pads. What happened?
Yeah, you're right, Mike. I think most people, many people remember John Carlos and Tommy Smith at the 68 Olympics. On the medal platform, Tommy Smith wins the gold, John wins the bronze. And when they're presented with their medals on the platform in Mexico City, they bow their heads and they had a black glove on and they raised their fist in a black power salute, protesting racial injustice in America. At that time, it was considered beyond shocking. And there was a huge uproar, and the USOC sent them home immediately. They didn't even get to stay with the team. Sent them home. They came back to this storm of criticism in this country and were really vilified. And their careers kind of brought to an end. Their opportunities dried up in track. And, you know, here's John Carlos, you know, looking around for something to do. And 1970, the Eagles just decided, oh, what the heck? Let's just draft this guy and see if we can turn him into a football player. He was 6'4", he was 215 pounds, and he could run like the wind. So they draft him in the 15th round of the draft. Carlos comes to the training camp, Albright College in Reading. I'm a rookie reporter. It's my first year covering the team. And the very first day of practice, we were allowed in the locker room then. We're not now, but we were then. And me and another writer were walking out of the locker room, and everybody's out on the field. They're already started practice. And we look down this row of lockers. There's one guy. It's John Carlos. And he's standing there, and he's in a T-shirt and socks and nothing else. And all of his equipment is spread out on the floor around him. And the other writer, Billy Shefsky of the Daily News, says, "You got a problem?" And he says, "I don't know how to put this on." And he had never worn a football uniform before. I mean, he had never played organized football. He had played touch football in the streets of Harlem, but he had never played any organized football. Wow. He never played helmet, shoulder pad type of football. So all of this stuff, for, I don't know if anybody in the audience really appreciates, you know, if you've never put on a football uniform before, somebody kind of has to show you how to do it. You know, somebody has to show you where the pads go and all that stuff. And so John had no idea where to begin. And so Billy and I, it's hardly our job description, but, you know, we can't leave the guy just standing here. So we went down there, and he and I and one player, one teammate, actually kind of came in and helped us a little bit. The rest of the guys just kept going. And we dressed John Carlos for his first practice in the NFL.
The reason that our lives intersected is that at that camp at Reading, my father, who was a high school and college football official, got for him like the call of his life to referee a scrimmage between the Billy Kilmer Redskins and the Eagles. And my brother and I held the first down chains for that scrimmage. I'll never forget it. So I was there as like a, you know, eight, it may have been the next year, 9 year old, you were there in your first camp. I was surprised, and I think that some of the viewers will be surprised, that in the book, when you describe your most memorable Eagles team, it's not the Super Bowl champions, it's the Buddy Ryan Eagles of the 1980s. Why?
The makeup of the players, the characters, the personalities. That was an exciting, combustible, chaotic locker room. With a whole bunch of oversized personalities. And Buddy was all of that himself as a coach. And it was just this daily bubbling stew of testosterone and ego. And you just never knew what was going to happen. And you had what you really had. I had never seen it quite to this degree. You really had two different teams. You had the offense and you had the defense. And every day in practice, there were fights. I mean, every day in practice, there were fights. And largely, it was largely of Buddy's doing, because Buddy was a defensive guy. And the defensive players were his. That was his baby, was the defense. He paid all of his attention on the defense. And those guys could get away with murder. And they did. And so on the practice field, and they were rough. I mean, it was Seth Joyner and Reggie White and Jerome Brown and Clyde Simmons and Wes Hopkins and Andre Waters. They were a tough bunch. And it wasn't just on Sunday. They were tough on Wednesday at practice, too. And on practice, they would just beat up on the offense. And finally, the offensive guys would just have enough of it. And there were fights all over the place. And the thing that I always remember about those training camps and about those practices was the fight would start inevitably. And the other coaches would kind of run in and try and break it up. And Buddy would just stand off to the side. Buddy had his whistle. And Buddy would just stand off to the side and he would just twirl his whistle. He would just stand off to the side, twirl his whistle with this, you know, impish kind of grin on his face that, all right, just break it up, fellas. Come on, break it up. It was such a contrast to the Dick Vermeil teams, you know, where everything was regimented. Everything was about discipline. Everything was about we're all in this together, guys. You know, Buddy took it in a totally different direction.
So I want to ask you about the Vermeil era and more particularly my favorite part of the book. You have a whole chapter, chapter 9, The Peddler's Son, about a guy that fascinates me. And I just wish the movie had been made. And I'm talking about Leonard Toews. And I can't get enough of the stories of he and Jimmy Murray, including the picture that you paint of the two of them on this renegade mission out to the Beverly Hills Hotel to try and recruit Vermeil, who's just won the Rose Bowl, to come to Philadelphia. Vermeil pulls up, I think you said, in a baby blue Mustang. Right. And now they're trying to cajole him at the Beverly Hills Hotel to come to Philadelphia. And Vermeil mentions, and Ray, this is another, for me, of I was there, Vermeil mentions the 42-3 loss to the Rams on Monday Night Football, where golf balls come down from the 700 level, and he wants to know if it's true. And Jimmy Murray says to Vermeil, if you come to Philadelphia, you'll never leave.
You'll never
How
leave.
How the hell did they close that deal?
You'll never leave. Mike, you describe it very well. There's really not a whole lot I can add to it. First of all, Leonard Toews had no idea who Dick Vermeil was. he had just fired his third coach. And he's casting about looking for the next coach. And they had interviewed half a dozen guys, including Joe Paterno. And Leonard wasn't sold on any of them. And so comes New Year's Day, and he and Jimmy Murray are together and are flipping around watching the various bowl games. And they flip over to the Rose Bowl. And all of a sudden, Jimmy says, "Whoa, look at this. UCLA's knocking off Ohio State. This is an upset." Ohio State was undefeated. They were heavily favored, number one team in the country. A lot of people were saying, like, the greatest college team of all time. And UCLA spanking them in the Rose Bowl. And as Jimmy describes it, they cut to a close-up of Vermeil on the sidelines, this UCLA coach. And he's 39, handsome as all get out, and just coaching his butt off. And as Jimmy describes it, he says he looked like Robert Redford and he coached like General Patton. And Leonard Toews says, "Who's this?"
Right.
And he says, "Well, that's Dick Vermeil. He's the coach of UCLA." And Leonard says, "Oh, we got to go talk to this guy." Now, 5 minutes ago, he had no idea who this guy was. Now he's ready to offer him the job. They hop on a plane the next day, fly to Los Angeles, and call Vermeil's office. They check into the Beverly Hills Hotel, get their cabana by the pool.
Sure.
Call Vermeil and say, "Hey, we want to talk to you about the Eagles job." Vermeil says, "Not interested." Hangs up. And one of the other guys, Carl Peterson, who's in the office with him, says, "Dick, you can't do that. At least you got to go talk to them. My God, they flew all the way across the country." So Dick calls back and says, "All right, you know, I'll come over by the time. It's just a courtesy. I'm just a courtesy, you know, because I really have no great desire to leave here." He had a great job. He's a native Californian, never coached outside of California. He's just beaten Ohio. He's just beaten Woody Hayes in the Rose Bowl. His stock has never been higher. He's got kids lined up all the way to Wilshire Boulevard wanting to sign up and play for him. He's got the greatest job in the world. And he walks in and he says to Jimmy Murray, "Why in the world would I want to leave here and come to Philadelphia and coach the Eagles, a team that hadn't won in forever?" And Jimmy goes into the thing about how passionate a fan base this is, how long they've been down, how desperately they want to win. And Jimmy says to him, these people are so desperate, they will give you a standing ovation if you win the coin toss. And then he follows up with the promise that you just talked about, which is, and Jimmy says, the people in Philadelphia, you can't appreciate how great they are and how much they love this team. And I guarantee you, you will love the people in the city. You will love the city. If you come to Philadelphia, you will never leave. And
he has it.
And Dick just buys it. He totally believes what Jimmy says. He understands what he's taking on, which is a broken down team that hasn't won in a decade, has traded away all their draft choices. I mean, it was probably the worst job in football, but Jimmy talked Dick into taking it. And with that, they totally changed the direction of the franchise.
The rest is history. Hey, let me switch sports, because I could keep you to myself all night long, but I'm limited on time and I'm going to ask some questions proposed by the audience in a moment. On the Phillies front, you speculate in the book that Mike Schmidt was booed more than any other athlete in the city history. Mm-hmm. Why?
I don't know. And I don't know that that's totally factual. And in fact, I think I write in the book that I don't know how you measure things like that.
Right.
You know, who was booed the most? Who could say? Look, we all kind of remember, at least I'm old enough that I remember Dick Allen, and I remember what Dick Allen went through here, and he was certainly booed. You know, we heard Norm Snead booed at Franklin Field a lot. You know, later on we heard Ryan Howard booed. We heard, I think the only guy that I can honestly say that in the 50 years I've been watching sports in Philly or covering it, the only one I never heard booed, honestly never heard booed, was Dr. J. I don't think I ever heard Doc booed in Philadelphia. Don't think so. Bobby Clark, maybe two. But it's a very small club. But Mike, if he wasn't booed the most, he might have been booed the most unjustly. When you consider what a great, truly great player he was. He was, I don't know how many people realize this. In fact, when I was writing the book and I began looking up his numbers, I mean, I covered him throughout his whole career. I knew it. I wrote it over time. But even I, when I looked at the numbers, even I was stunned at some of he won the National League home run title 8 times. He led the National League in home runs 8 different seasons. The only hitter in Major League history that won his league home run title more, not Barry Bonds, not Hank Aaron, it was Babe Ruth, who led the American League in home runs 14 times back in the dead ball era. But in the modern era, no hitter led his league in home runs more than Mike Schmidt did. His numbers are just staggering.
The reason that I bring up the boo factor with regard to Schmidt, and I hope I'm not giving away too much, is that one of the questions that people always want to ask of Ray Didinger is, please rank the athletes you covered.
Sure.
And a guy that you speculate may have been booed the most is also your number one ranking by a whisker over Reggie White.
Yeah, I think that's true, Mike. I felt like in doing the book, I couldn't very well do a book about my 50 years of covering Philly sports without somewhere in the book saying, who did I think was the greatest athlete I covered? It would have been a major cop-out. but I knew it was going to be a tough decision because I covered some great ones. And I finally came down to, it was a choice between two. It was a choice between Mike Schmidt and Reggie White. Each of them was the best I ever saw play in their position. Schmidt was the best third baseman I ever saw. And Reggie was the best defensive end I ever saw. So I thought it was between those two. And as much as I loved Reggie and respected Reggie, and I still think he's one of the greatest players ever, I had to give it to Schmidt in terms of his longevity and just the fact that as an all-around player, hitting with power, run the bases, fielding. Guy won 10 gold gloves. He was the complete package at third base. So, yeah, I picked him as my number one guy. But you're right. I think that he got booed viciously throughout his career and was largely because of kind of his persona. He was by his own design, he was very cool. He was kind of Mr. Cool. He just played the game in almost an effortless-looking fashion. And Philadelphia, listen, we all know who's popular in this town. It's a guy that gets their uniforms dirty. It's a guy that gets their nose bloody. It's a guy that dives headfirst into the bases. Schmidt was never like that. I mean, I write in the book that Schmidt looked like he played the game in top hat and tails. He really did. I mean, he was that good, and he could get away with it. And the fans here, they kind of want it more. I remember saying one time to Mike, I said, you know what, you and Ron Say should really change teams.
Right.
You tell me. I said, you should go, you would be perfect in LA. The whole cool thing, the sunglasses, you'd be perfect in LA. And Ron Say, you know, with that penguin waddle and that funny little stumpy body that he had, you know, the Philadelphia fans would love him. And of course, Mike, you know, Mike just totally took it the wrong way. And what are you saying? Ron Say's better than I? I said, no, I'm not even suggesting that. It's not even a question. I'm just saying in terms of what those fan bases relate to, the kind of players that they really like, I said, you'd be great in L.A. And Ron Say would be a hero here because he'd have his uniform dirty every night. That's all I'm saying. And I remember Schmitty saying, you know, you guys are unbelievable. But that was just Schmitty. That was kind of the relationship we had. But when I had to sit down and pick what I thought was the greatest player that I saw in Philadelphia in 50 years, in the end, it was actually a pretty easy call. It was Mike Schmidt.
So the book, people should know, is not just a concentration on what I would regard as the big four in Philadelphia. And some of my favorite stories deviate beyond the Flyers and Sixers and so forth. I loved, and I'll just float it out there as an invitation for people to buy the book. I love you covering in the mid 80s, the pro wrestling circuit and the role played by your wife, Maria, and Andre the Giant. They'll have to buy the book to hear that story. Something else that jumped out at me, Ray, because I remember Frazier Ali won at the Garden. It's 1971. I'm living in suburbia. My recollection is, you know, a young kid. My recollection is that my brother and I had a transistor radio tuned to WFIL who had someone at the Spectrum watching the closed circuit who would call in round by round and give you a feel for what had gone on. Okay, you're at the Spectrum that night, but a few years later, you're at Deer Lake and you are with the greatest. And what did he want to know from Ray Didinger?
I went up to Deer Lake to interview LA. He was training for another fight. And it was just him and me alone. I don't know how many people have ever seen pictures of Deer Lake. Deer Lake was, it was way up in the mountains near Pottsville. I mean, you could get lost so easy getting up there. Most people did. And I was the only reporter there that day. So I had LA alone to myself in his log cabin. I'm interviewing him and we're sitting at this little card table. That's what I describe it. We're talking for about an hour and about a lot of different things, great fighters in history. And I bring up the name of Joe Frazier. At this time, he had fought Frazier once. And Ellie says, do you see my fight with Joe Frazier? And I said, yeah. I said, I was at the closed circuit at the Spectrum, watching on the big screen. And Ellie leans across the table until his nose is like that far from my face. And he says, who was you rooting for? Now, just imagine that, okay? Imagine that moment. You're alone in a log cabin with Muhammad Ali. His face is right here, and he's asked you that question, okay? And, look, I knew what he wanted me to say, but the simple fact of the matter is I was rooting for Joe Frazier. And so I, in my mind, a million things are going through my mind, but I finally say, you know, he asked me an honest question. I got to give him an honest answer. And I looked right in the eye and I said, I was rooting for Joe Frazier, not knowing what he was going to do. And he just fell back in his chair and he looked at me. He said, why was you rooting for Joe Frazier? And I said, I'm from Philadelphia. I was rooting for the home team. And he just looked at me, and I really didn't know where the thing was going to go from that. But he said, then all of a sudden, his expression changes, and he says, you know something? I respect you for telling me that. And it was a funny thing, Mike, because the whole drive back to Philadelphia after leaving Deer Lake, I'm rolling this around in my head. What's he talking about? You know, respect, why? Respect what? You know, that I wanted Frazier to beat him? And I still don't know exactly what he was thinking, but the best thing I can make sense out of it is you know, he was so surrounded by people that just patted him on the back and said, champ, you're the greatest, you're the best, whatever you want, champ. And to have somebody just give him a straight answer to something was, it was something, even though it wasn't what he wanted to hear, he could kind of just appreciate the honesty.
Right. I grew up idolizing Bernie Perrant. You know, our family had the bumper sticker, only the Lord saves more than Perrant. I'm sure you and everybody listening and watching remember. So February 1979, he suffers that freakish eye injury. You are the only reporter at the hospital. And it's a very poignant moment. And in the book, you describe being uncomfortable at the access that you've been given.
Very, very, because it was a Saturday afternoon. And I was the second guy covering for the Bulletin. Jack Chevalier was the beat guy. He was writing about the game. I was there to just do a sidebar of some kind. And during the game, all of a sudden, there's this freakish sort of scramble in front of the goal. Jimmy Watson pulls down one of the New York Rangers. His stick swings back. And the tip of his stick goes in the eye hole of Bernie's mask. I mean, it's just an 8 million to 1 thing, freak. But that's what happens. The tip of the stick goes right into the eye hole and hits Bernie right on the eye. He flips the mask off, skates off the ice with his hand on his eye, clearly in pain. Goes up the tunnel, and like 5 minutes later, they announce that Bernie's now being taken to Will's Eye Hospital for examination. And Jack Chevalier says to me, you go. I'll stay here and cover the game. You go and just see what's going on with Bernie. At that time, we didn't know how bad it was. We just thought maybe he got a grazing kind of thing and this is just precautionary. So I get in the car and I drive up to Will's Eye Hospital, which was on Spring Garden then. And I go in they tell me what room Bernie's in. I go up to the room, there's nobody else around. I'm in a room by myself. And then all of a sudden I see him and his wife, Carol, coming up the hall. And he's in a wheelchair and he has both eyes covered with gauze and taped. And Carol's crying. And I thought, oh my, you know, this is serious. And they bring Bernie in, the nurse pushes him in, and she sees me standing there. She says, who are you? And I said, I'm a reporter from the Bulletin. She says, get out. And Bernie, his eyes are covered, but he recognizes my voice. And he said, no, it's okay. I know him. And she says, and the nurse says to me, you have 5 minutes, and she leaves. And then I start to talk to Bernie and that's when he tells me kind of what happened and what the doctors said, and there's bleeding internally in the eye socket. And they don't know where this is going to go. And it becomes very clear to me, oh, this is really bad. And I remember talking to Ed Viner, who was the Flyers physician, after I left the room. I mean, I was there I got my 5 minutes. The nurse came and got me and I left. And then I saw Dr. Viner out in the hall. Dr. Viner, without giving me a whole lot of great detail, kind of said, this is really serious. And I remember going there that day and just thinking, well, you know, Bernie's hurt, but you know, he'll be back. I mean, he's Bernie, for God's sakes. And then by the time I got in the car to drive back to the office to write my story, I had a whole different feeling. And I remember thinking, I think I just saw the end of a great career.
You explain in the book, and we won't take the time to tell why now, but that as a lot, the best to cover have been the hockey guys.
Yes.
And probably because a guy like Bernie, such a wonderful, wonderful guy. And also, you know, there are a bunch of characters. Final question from me, and then I'm going to surrender the floor and pose some from the audience. But very touching to know that given your career and your half a century covering Philadelphia sports, and of course the photograph on the front, we all know where that picture was taken, that forever the Philly special will live on in history, not so much because of Ray Didinger, but because of David. Explain.
My son is a cameraman for NFL films, has been for more than 20 years. Really good cameraman. He has an Emmy to prove it. But his assignment the day of Super Bowl 52 was he shot the Nick Foles wiring. And for anybody that understands how NFL films works, you hear that sound, you hear guys talking in the game. They're actually mic'd. They're wearing a wire. There's a wire and a microphone built into their shoulder pads. And a couple of different guys were picked every week. And that day, they put the mic on Nick Foles, and my son was assigned to shoot nothing but Nick Foles. I mean, his whole camera, he did nothing but shoot Foles the whole day, coming out the tunnel, playing in the game, on the sidelines, on the bench. He just shot Nick Foles. And so that wonderful moment right before halftime, when Nick Foles goes over to the sidelines on fourth down, and he and Doug Peterson are having this conversation about what are we going to run on fourth down at the 1 yard line. And Nick Foles says, "Hey, how about Philly Philly?" And you can see Peterson isn't thinking that at all. I mean, not even anywhere in his brain is he thinking at all. But he suddenly looks up and it's clear to me that he sees something in Foles' eyes, that he sees something in Foles' face, that it's like, he really believes in this, you know, and he's the quarterback. He's the one that's going to have to make it work. If he believes in it, we're going with it. And that's when he says, yeah, let's do it. And so Foles comes back in, they run Philly special. Yeah, people in Philadelphia will remember it forever. My goodness, they have a statue of it outside the stadium now. But the reason that we all know the full context of that play is because of my son, because that was his shot and he got it. And after the game, he's the one that told me up in the press box when he came to see me when we were doing the postgame show. He says to me very quietly, he says, "Hey, Dad, Foles called that play." Wow. I said, "What are you talking about?" Wow. He said, I was shooting the wire. I heard him. He's the one that said, "You want Philly, Philly." If Foles isn't wearing that wire, we know none of that. You know, it's only because he was mic'd up. If he didn't wear that, we would have assumed that Doug called it. And it was a great play. We would have been a celebration and a win anyhow. But the fact that you actually now kind of see how the whole thing played out makes it so much better.
Ray, you speak as well as you write. You tell great stories. And I'm reminded that you worked for a great storyteller who left us too soon. As I look at the radio interviews that I've been privileged to conduct over 30 years, one that stands out for me is Steve Sable. And you are his match, because the two of you have lived such interesting lives and write and speak so beautifully. Let me surrender the floor. Christopher wants to know, what is the one story or column that you wish to have written that you did not, or one that you did write that you wish you could take back?
The one that I wish I could have written, easy. U.S. Soviets, Lake Placid, 1980. That's my great regret to this day, that I wasn't there in the barn that day watching that game, to have a chance to write about it, because I was supposed to be. I was at the Philadelphia Bulletin then, and I was the guy that was supposed to go and be the sole correspondent for the Philadelphia Bulletin and cover everything that those 3 weeks. And I got sick. I got a really bad flu, and my doctor wouldn't let me go. He said, "If you go, you're going to wind up in a hospital." So they had to send another reporter, and I had to sit on the couch and watch that all take place. And all I kept thinking was watching that game, watching that drama, watching that moment, that celebration. The only thing I could think was, God, how I wish I could be there. Because that's the moment, those are the kind of moments that you get into the business for. And I was supposed to go, and I didn't get to go. But what I did do was I made sure that I went down to Washington the next day, even though I was still sick. I knew the U.S. Olympic team was coming straight from Lake Placid to the White House to meet President Carter and Mrs. Carter. And I had heard about that, so I called down there to our Washington bureau and said, "Can you get me a credential and leave it for me at the gate at the White House? I'm coming. I got to get a piece of this story, even if it's after the fact." So I did. They called back. They said, "You got a credential. It'll be at the press gate." I go. I get there. And I got to actually do the follow-up, kind of the celebration a day later when they visited the White House. But I so wish I could have been in the arena for that game.
Bill says that he hopes it never happens, but under what circumstances would you consider retiring?
When it's no longer fun, when it starts to feel like a job, and I'll know that, I'll know it when it happens. That's when it'll be. I've loved it, Mike. I've loved it so much, and I've loved it for so long. 50 years has flown by. And I remember interviewing Marv Levy, the great Buffalo Bills coach. Marv Levy one time said, you know, I've been in football my whole life, but I've never worked a day. And I kind of know what he means by that. I mean, I've been in this business for a long time. And believe me, I was such a slow writer. I was such a painstakingly, agonizingly, impossibly slow writer that there was a lot of suffering in there, but it never felt like work because I knew this was what I always wanted to do. And when that feeling goes and it starts to feel like going to work again today, then I'll know it's time to leave.
Eric asks about some of the WIP personalities with whom you've worked. What's the secret to the marriage professionally that you have with Glenn Mack now?
I don't know. It just sort of happened. A lot of people think that because Glenn and I both had a newspaper background that we were friends before we started working together. I hardly knew him. I mean, he was at the Inquirer. I was at the Daily News. We were competitors, if anything. And I knew who he was. I knew he was a really good writer. And he had started doing some radio and made a seamless transition into radio. He's really good at it. And when they came up with the idea, why don't we put you two guys together? Because they had created something called the Saturday Sports Page with two sports writers. And it was me and Stan Hockman for a long time. And then Stan decided he wanted to go down the shore and spend time with Gloria, which I fully understand. Then they put me together with an Inquirer guy named Don McKee. That was for a little while. Then they said, we're going to put you with Glenn Mack now. Well, I said, okay. But when we first went together, we didn't know each other very much. But it's been like 20 years now. And we get along great. We really do. I mean, people find it hard to believe that during the pandemic, we've never really worked together. He does the show from his office in Havertown, and I'm in the studio, 2400 Market Street. We're that far apart doing the show, but for people listening, it sounds like we're sitting side by side. We just have that kind of chemistry. We're like, I use the description. I said, we're like two old New Orleans jazz musicians who have just been playing together for so long that we know what the other guy's thinking. We know the rhythms and we just know how to make it work.
John wants to know, having interviewed the most famous sports figures over the last 50 years, who's the one that got away? Is there someone you never had the opportunity to interview that you always wanted to?
Oh, good question. Of all the athletes that have competed in the last 50 years, I haven't missed too many. I've been lucky. I mean, I've been able to cast a pretty wide net, and I haven't, you know, I've gotten to pretty much interview all of them at one time or another. The one interview I would have loved to have done I would have loved to have interviewed Jim Thorpe. I would have loved to have interviewed Jim Thorpe. I just think his story it's an amazing story. What he accomplished as an athlete, playing multiple sports, winning the pentathlon and the decathlon. I mean, he truly is one of the greatest athletes that the world has ever seen. And his story about being a poor Indian boy and what he came through and the terrible breaks that he got in his life and still managed to overcome. I just found Jim Thorpe's story an incredible story, and he an incredible man. If there were one person that I wish I could have sat down and just talked to, it would be Jim Thorpe.
Brandon has already read the book, thinks it's fantastic, wonders, how did you decide what made the cut? And is there anything that ended up on the cutting room floor that you regret?
No regret. There was some picking and choosing that went on. I didn't expect that. I thought I have plenty of room here. But I was writing and I was remembering things and I was going through my files and it jogged my memory. And, oh man, I forgot all about that. Yeah, I got to put that in. And next thing you know, I'm 350 pages. And I'm just saying, you know, my life isn't that interesting that people are ready to sit down and read Ulysses. So I finally had to start taking some stuff out. And just culling it back and trying to bring it to what I consider to be kind of a manageable length. What's happened is there are a couple things that I forgot that if I had a chance to go back and write it again, I would say, I want that to put that in there.
Like what?
I'm going to put that in there. And I'll tell you very quickly what one of them is, because it was I was just reminded of it a couple weeks ago when Howard Schellenberger, the football coach, mostly remembered for the University of Miami, passed away. And I read that and I thought, ah, Howard Schellenberger. God, I wish I could have put that in the book. What happened was he was the head coach of the Baltimore Colts. And the Baltimore Colts came to Philadelphia in 1973, 74, right there. And they played the Eagles at the Vet. And the Eagles killed them. The Colts were terrible. And Bob Irsay was the owner of the Colts. This was the Colts before they moved to Indianapolis. They were still the Baltimore Colts. And Bob Irsay is the owner. And he gets mad at Schellenberger, who's the coach. He wants him to change quarterbacks. And Schellenberger tells him, no, I'm not changing quarterbacks. You're not coaching the team. I'm coaching the team. So the game ends. They lose. Eagles win. Irsay goes in the locker room and fires Howard Schellenberger in the locker room in Philadelphia. So word gets down to the Eagles locker room where I'm doing my interviews. And I scamper down the hall to get this story. I mean, they just fired their coach, for God's sakes. Week four of the season. So I'm in the office of Schellenberger and about four or five Baltimore writers. And Schellenberger's behind the desk saying, hey, well, I sure didn't see this coming. And then all of a sudden, at one point, he says, hey, wait, they didn't leave, did they? And I look out the door and I said, yeah, coach, they're gone. That the Colts had just packed up all their stuff, their trunks, wheeled them out, got on the bus, and they took off. Because Schellenberger's not the coach anymore.
Right.
So now here's this guy sitting by his desk. And he says, wow, well, how am I going to get home? And the Baltimore writers couldn't help them because they all had to go upstairs and file their stories. So I said, well, coach, I'm going back to the Philadelphia Bulletin office to write my story. That's 30th and Market Street, 30th Street Station's right across the street. I'll give you a ride back. You can go to 30th Street, maybe buy a train ticket. So he says, okay. So we go outside. He climbs, Howard Schellenberger climbs into my 1968 Pontiac Firebird.
Oh, my God.
And off we go to the Schuylkill Expressway. Now we're sitting in traffic. You know, the guys that we had never met before. He didn't know me. He's not like we had any relationship. And a guy, man, just got fired as coach of the Colts. He's staring out the window. You know, how do you like make conversation here? It's one of the most awkward rides you could ever imagine. You know, we pull up the 30th Street Station. I say, okay, coach, that's the Bulletin Building. I got to go in there and write my story. That's 30th Street Station. You know, just go in there. You'll find the ticket office. And you give somebody a call, they'll come and pick you up at the train station. Off he went. And then 4 years later, the next time I saw him, it was in the Orange Bowl when he coached the University of Miami and Bernie Kosar to that tremendous upset of Nebraska. Two different moments in a guy's career.
Holy smokes. Hey, Tammy wants to know, Hall of Fame for McNabb, T.O., Foles. Bing, bang, boom.
Well, T.O.'s in. He didn't show up to accept the honors, but he was inducted. Foles, no. And Don, there are a lot of people that think he should be. He has very good numbers. If I were still voting, I wouldn't vote for him. I think he was a good player, at times a very good player. I don't characterize him in my mind as a great player. And to me, that's what the Hall of Fame is for. The Hall of Fame isn't for good players, and it isn't for really good players. It's for the great players. And to me, Donovan just didn't quite cross that threshold.
So Bill asks about the Snowball Santa game. What was your take on it? And I'm going to expand that because having read the book, I know that when Jeffrey Lurie comes to town, he wants to go to dinner at Morton's with you and understand, you know, the history and the psyche of the city.
Right.
And this subject comes up. Explain.
Yeah, that was it. Jeff had just bought the team. He was a New England guy. He's from Boston. 1960, when the Eagles won the championship, he was at Fenway Park rooting for the Patriots and Babe Parilli. So he bought the team, he felt like there was a lot that he needed to know. And so somebody had told him, well, there's this guy here that's been following the team forever. And when he was 10 years old, he was up at training camp carrying Tommy McDonald's helmet. And, why don't you take him out? Why don't you go to dinner and he can talk you through it. So PR guy called me, so would you go to lunch with Jeffrey at Morton's, talk about the Eagles? I said, sure, no problem. And so we're having a very nice lunch. Jeff's asking me a lot of questions about this and that, trying to help him best I can. And then at one point, he just sort of leans over and says, did they really throw snowballs at Santa Claus? Because he had heard the story, and I think he thought in his own mind, oh, that didn't really happen. You know, that's one of those stories that, you know, it started as a joke, and then it got repeated, and, you know, now people think it happened, but it didn't really happen. I said, yeah, it happened. I was there, December 1968. I was there when they threw snowballs at Santa Claus. But then, Mike, I tried to do the good thing. I tried to put it in context. I said, look, you kind of got to understand what 1968 was. You know, the owner was going bankrupt. The coach was under siege. Planes were flying over the stadium, trailing a banner that said, Joe must go. The team had won just two games, but it was enough to blow the first pick in the draft, who was O.J. Simpson. I mean, it was a year when everything that could go wrong did go wrong, and then some. So I said the fans were not in a good mood, okay? And final game of the season, they're losing to the Vikings. It had snowed the day before. The stands were full of snow. Well, what do you expect the people to do? You know, they're going to throw snowballs. And it just so happened that this sort of ragamuffin-looking Santa Claus came out on the track and started walking around with a bag of really cheap candy canes, throwing them in the crowd. And, you know, people started throwing snowballs. But I will always contend that that they were thoroughly provoked. So I tried to tell Jeff, yes, it happened.
Right.
But you have to understand the context.
Hey, really great question from Robert. Have you ever been offered a job within a football organization? And if not, would you have taken it were it offered?
I never have. People ask that question a lot. Was I ever, did the Eagles or any other team ever approach me to be GM or ask me to be a scout, that kind of thing? No,
yeah.
No, never happened. Some people were asking me that this year. If the Eagles offered you a job as GM, this was when a lot of people were wanting to move on from Howie Roseman. And I said, no, I'm 75 years old and not about ready to make a career change. But if it had happened earlier in my career, you know, when I was in my 30s, if somebody had come to me and talked about being a GM or a scout, yeah, I probably would have taken a shot at it, especially if it had been the Eagles. I've been around this team literally since I was a little boy, going up to training camp. And the opportunity to be in management and help pick players and maybe, you know, help this team win a championship. Yeah, it would have been, that's something I couldn't have said no to. Now, I don't know if I would have been any good at it. Probably not. But if it had been offered to me at that point in my life, yeah, I probably would have taken it. But now I'm afraid that's come and gone.
Ray, Eric wants to know who signed the football behind you.
Oh, Tommy McDonald.
Wow.
That's Tommy McDonald.
And yeah, I've not delved into that subject because I want to leave something big untouched for those who read it. But the discussion of being the whole little brother story, and those who have, of course, seen the play or know of the play, they know it. But that was really remarkable. All right, what the hell? I will ask. So why didn't you tell them until you finally told them? And people who know what I'm talking about, they'll get it, and the rest will read the book.
Yeah, I didn't tell him because I was afraid he wouldn't remember. You know, we had this relationship when I was a little boy at training camp where I carried his helmet every day to the practice field. And he made me feel special. And I waited for him every day at the locker room, and he would hand me his helmet. We would take that walk. And we would talk about stuff and talk about his career. And, you know, he took me for a ride in his convertible around Hershey where training camp was. And he called me little brother. And that was the relationship that we had. And then obviously he gets traded, his career ends. I go on to become a sports writer. And then years later, I'm a sports writer in Philadelphia. We get to meet again at Maxwell Club Affairs, whatever. And I never, even though there's a part of me that said, I gotta tell him about that. I didn't, because my fear was that I would say to him, you know, I was that little kid up in Hershey. I was that kid, and my great fear was he would say, yeah, gee, I don't remember.
Right.
And that would have that would have hurt so bad.
It devastated, yeah. Sure.
That would have hurt so bad. So I never wanted to ask him because I didn't dare the disappointment. I just in my mind, I kind of kept hoping that he remembered that little guy, but it didn't matter one way or another that he knew it was me.
I'm going to wind down with a very, I think, appropriate final comment from Gloria Hockman, who says, "I'm Stan's wife, and I think you know how Stan felt about you, Ray. As you know, he was a tough critic, but early in your career, he spotted you as the most talented, most insightful football writer in the country. I wish he were here to read your book and chat with you about what you've brought to those of us lucky enough to read and hear you."
Well, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. I love Gloria and I love Stan. He was one of my heroes. At a very early age, I used to read the sports page every day. And I had a couple of heroes. Sandy Grady, who wrote for the Philadelphia Bulletin. Larry Merchant, who wrote for the Philadelphia Daily News. This was Larry Merchant before he went on HBO. And Stan Hockman. They were my heroes. They were my role models. They were heroes to me every bit as much as Richie Allen, every bit as much as Johnny Callison, every bit as much as Norm Van Brocklin. Because I was never going to be those guys. You know, I was never going to be the quarterback of the Eagles. I was never going to be starting pitcher for the Phillies. But there was a chance I could be in a press box. There was a chance I could do that. So in terms of attainable hero worship, the guys like Stan were the people that I just watched and just admired. And I thought Stan was great. I mean, he was such a pioneer, and that he was the first journalist that was a real crossover. I mean, he was a print guy, but he started doing radio, and then he became the weekend sports anchor at Channel 6. I mean, he did everything. You know, it's not that unusual to see that today, but Stan was the first, and I mean the first by 30 years. It was great when I finally got into the business and I met him, and I found out that he was as wonderful a man as he was a writer. And he was so encouraging to me and so supportive of me. He could never understand why it took me so long to write. He could never, because Stan wrote so fast, and I wrote so slow. But Mike, Gloria loves this story. So for Gloria, I will tell this story. 1977 World Series, Yankees Dodgers. There's an off day, and Reggie Jackson has just been impossible to deal with for the whole World Series. Just a total pain in the butt. And on an off day, I've had it with him. So I sit down and I write a story where I just eviscerate Reggie Jackson. The Philadelphia Bulletin runs it 8 columns across the top. Headline, "Oh, Reggie, what a bore you've become." Okay, now comes the game. That night, Yankee Stadium. I walk in the press room. First person I see is Stan. Stan says, "That was a pretty tough column you wrote about Reggie." And I said, "Stan, I've had it with that guy. I'm sick of his whole act." So Stan says, "Oh, all right." Now, what Stan understood far better than me is you don't tempt fate with Mr. October in October. That's the night that Reggie Jackson, first time up, first pitch, home run. Second time up, first pitch, home run. Third time up, first pitch, home run. It never happened before in the history of baseball, but it happens that night, the night that I have ripped Reggie Jackson. So I'm sitting in my seat watching Reggie circle the bases for the third time. And Stan comes over and taps me on the shoulder. And he says, "I think he hit the last one with a rolled up bullet."
That's a great line.
I can laugh about it now. I wasn't laughing about it at the time, but I can laugh about it now. Gloria loves that story, so I'm telling it for Gloria's sake. But I so love Stan and I love Gloria. And the fact that Stan actually saw promise in me and was one of the guys who helped bring me from the Bulletin to the Daily News, that he lobbied on my behalf, still to this day means the world to me.
Ray, there's a lot of love in the comments. The book is great for those who've not yet read it. Thanks. This was a lot of fun for me, and I hope I've made it clear how much I enjoyed the walk down memory lane with you and with a big slice of the sports history of Philadelphia.
Thanks, Mike. I really enjoyed it, and I hope folks enjoy the book. And all I can say is it's been a wonderful 50 years, and thank you all for sharing it with me.
Good night, everybody. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.